Seneca, 22, AD 58. Liar, hypocrite, adulterer. Hi everyone, and welcome back to this podcast series on the life of Lucius Annaeus Seneca. AD 57 had been, in terms of what was to follow, a pretty uneventful year, and it was one to which even the ancient commentators barely gave a second glance. But AD 58 was to prove a whole different kettle of fish. So it's going to be worth setting the scene a bit before getting on to how the events of AD 58 directly impacted Seneca himself. As far as Roman domestic affairs were concerned, I'll start off with a beautiful young upper-class Roman woman called Poppaea Sabina. No stranger to the imperial whims, selective memories, and intergenerational grudges of the Julio-Claudian imperial house, she'd deliberately taken the family, or gens name, of her illustrious maternal grandfather, Gaius Poppaeus Sabina, to avoid the stigma attached to the name of her immediate father, Titus Oileus, whose friendship with Sejanus, the still-reviled henchman of Tiberius, had ruined him. Now, Poppaea, as she's commonly called in history, was beautiful, rich, and smart, and it's probably because of those advantages that the ancient commentators gave her some pretty bad press. They called her depraved, self-centered, and sexually indiscriminate. Although already married, she was brought to the attention of the young Nero, and he became instantly smitten. According to some accounts, the wily Poppaea played Nero like a fish, driving a wedge between the impetuous emperor and his existing mistress Acte, although even the appearance of a new love interest on the scene didn't stop the wayward Nero from frequenting sleazy night venues near the Milvian Bridge outside of Rome proper, a place where the revels could run unlicensed, free and unfettered from any social protocols that might put a lid on the fun in the city itself. I'll be talking more about the intrigue in Poppaea in later podcasts, but for now, suffice to say that once again, the introduction of a smart and scheming woman into palace affairs would wreak future havoc and prove responsible for more than one high-profile death. And on the wider political canvas, I should mention Nero's impetuous attempt to abolish taxation. Ever the one for the big dramatic gesture, and one which would incidentally have made him extremely popular with a massive chunk of Roman citizens both at home and overseas, even Nero had to eventually see sense. He was reined in by his advisers, Seneca included, and the Senate, and made to abandon his ridiculous plan, which would have quickly emptied the state treasury and bankrupted the machine of empire. In my opinion, this little episode throws into sharp relief Nero's incredible political naivety and gives us an insight into his personality. He was a showman, a bunkum artist, big on dramatic appeal, but with absolutely zero political acumen or forethought to back anything up. And that meant that Rome was in serious trouble. Did Seneca know or sense just how much trouble back in AD 58? Well, perhaps. But just like Nero, Seneca wasn't really helping himself either, because he too was spouting off on things he couldn't back up. And that's a situation which will inform the second half of this podcast. And as for poor old Agrippina, the once mighty, if short-lived, power behind the throne, wife to one emperor, mother to the next, well, she was now a ghost of her former self. By AD 58, she had no cards left to play, and the ancient commentators, treating her with no respect or mercy, began to shred what remained of her already tattered reputation. Depicted by them as a sad harridan, whose only remaining weapon was her fading sexual allure, She was accused of having sex with just about anybody, including committing incest with her son Nero and adultery with her once strongest ally, Seneca himself. For my part, I can see no evidence for either of these allegations. Agrippina's relationship with Seneca had soured long before AD 58, and as for incest with Nero, that is likely to be the product of the boy's growing disrespect for his own mother, because it's reported that one of his mistresses had some physical similarity to Agrippina, and after having intercourse with that mistress, Nero would put it about that he was having sex with his mother. On the international stage, the war with the Parthians over Armenia had intensified, with the experienced general Nios Domitios Corbulo employing a combination of cunning military and political stratagems to turn the conflict strongly in Rome's favour. Now we need to bear this in mind, because when news of Corbulo's success was brought back to Rome, Nero was voted honours and thanksgiving by a grateful senate, and Rome's military might and prowess were high in the popular imagination. So now let's turn to how AD 58 treated Seneca himself, how it impacted him, and how he reacted. By the year AD 58, Seneca was undergoing a serious credibility crisis. Here was this man, a self-confessed, dedicated adherent of the school of Stoic philosophical thought, a man who published book after book about how to lead a principled and self-regulated lifestyle of moderation, a man who publicly, through books like De Brevitate Vitae and De Ira, even actively advised other figures in the public eye how to behave. And yet, Seneca was looking, to all intents and purposes, to be complicit in what was fast becoming yet another Julio-Claudian principate of vice and debauchery. Seneca had even written a book, De Clementia, a few years back, in an attempt to regulate the behaviour of the newly acceded Nero into developing and blossoming into that philosophical holy grail, a philosopher king. But everybody, Seneca and his mate Burrus, the Praetorian commander included, knew by AD 58 that Nero as philosopher king was something that was never going to happen. It was a pipe dream. Nero, it was obvious to everybody, was already well off the rails and dancing to his own tune. So where was Seneca in all this? What was he, as the amicus principis, the emperor's closest advisor, doing about it all? All the public could see Seneca doing was reaping the benefits of living life high on the hog. There seemed to be a massive discrepancy between what Seneca practiced and what Seneca preached. As far as accusations of hypocrisy were concerned, by AD 58, Lucius Annaeus Seneca was an absolute sitting duck with a massive target painted on his toga. And sure enough, the attacks started to come. The mouthpiece of those accusations was one Publius Suaelius, a senator. And I'll come to what he said in a moment. But first, I think we need to delve a little into his background and his personal situation in AD 58 to understand why he decided to single out Seneca as a target on whom he was going to spit out all his bile and vitriol. Suaelius, it seems, had been very active as a legal advocate during the reign of Nero's stepfather, the Emperor Claudius. It's well documented that Claudius, especially towards the end of his reign, took an enthusiastic, some might say an overly enthusiastic, interest in legal proceedings, and he'd even, at times, turn up unannounced at proceedings to either just sit and watch or actively interfere. Now, Suaelius is supposed to have benefited from this diversion from procedural norm and earned a lot of money from it, especially as the sources hint that Claudius looked favourably upon him. On the flip side, Suaelius's success under the emperor's protection had also made him a lot of enemies. Emperors, though, come and go. Nevertheless, Suaelius obviously imagined that the individual favour and protection that was extended to him by Claudius was going to be continued by Nero. So on the strength of that supposition, he continued as before, behaving in a venal fashion and making enemies at every turn with his malpractice. It simply had to stop. Now, although the ancient accounts will give only the barest outline of Suaelius's fall from grace, his singling out of Seneca to try to get his own back informs me that Seneca was one of the minds, if not the mind, behind finally getting the odious senator removed. When Suaelius became too much to bear, the Senate, in my opinion with Seneca directing them, reenacted an old law that forbade advocates from taking fees, which was something Suaelius had been doing and then some, but under some other guise. Suaelius had obviously made too many enemies, accepted too many bribes over the years, so there were plenty of witnesses to condemn him, and he stood little chance of winning the case brought against him. But I'm sure he knew it was Seneca who had orchestrated his downfall, and so Suaelius decided he was going to take Seneca down with him. After all, in Suaelius's mind, when it came to accepting money for questionable reasons, as Seneca seemed to be doing as Nero's advisor, wasn't he as, if not more, culpable than Suaelius himself? And it must be said, Suaelius had a lot of ammunition to work with, because it quickly became very obvious that he did not like Lucius Annaeus Seneca one tiny bit. Publius Suaelius's attack on Seneca is well documented by the ancient commentators, with some of them, even though writing a generation or more later, barely able to hide their glee at the character assassination, because Suaelius had done his homework really, really well. And I think it's important to point out here that to make the accusations I'm about to relate, Suaelius must have felt he was on very solid ground and tapping into what he thought anyway was the groundswell of popular opinion. And it would also be a safe bet that Suaelius was not acting alone and that he was speaking in his trial as the mouthpiece of an anti-Seneca lobby, a group of senators who were resentful and or jealous of Seneca's power and influence. Suaelius's opening salvo was an attempt to get the Senate on his side by stating that Seneca had obviously disliked the former emperor Claudius because it was Claudius who had exiled Seneca to Corsica back in AD 41. And this despite Seneca himself writing much later that it had been only through Claudius's intervention that the punishment was mitigated from execution to exile. Suaelius's allegation here then would suggest he was trying to make it sound as if Seneca's personal dislike of Claudius had led him to drum up so-called evidence from that emperor's reign, which involved dubious legal proceedings, and Suaelius's part in them under Claudius's protection. So again, this informs me that Seneca was the main player in the party acting against Suaelius, especially as Nero himself, probably under Seneca's prompting, actively stepped in to deny that his stepfather Claudius had been complicit in any judicial jiggery-pokery during his reign. Suaelius then went on to appeal to the Roman sense of virtus, that is manly, mostly military prowess, telling the assembled body that Seneca had been fornicating in adultery while Suaelius himself had been serving on the staff of the great Germanicus, a direct appeal there for sympathy by bringing in the still much-loved general, and made all the more poignant because A, There is no evidence that Seneca ever played any active military role. And B, the woman Seneca was supposed to be committing adultery with was Germanicus's daughter, Julia Livilla. Moreover, in AD 58, it was well known that the extremely competent General Corbulo was turning the war with the Parthians in Armenia around and enjoying great military success, which made it something else that Suaelius could play on by highlighting Seneca's lack of martial pedigree. Suaelius must have felt he was on pretty firm ground with the adultery accusations, though, because Seneca was still, even in AD 58, under the cloud of having committed adultery with Julia Livilla back in AD 41, the charge that had got him exiled to Corsica for 8 or 9 long years. This time, though, Suaelius accused Seneca of having sex with Agrippina. He'd obviously not learned his lesson, said Suaelius, about shagging imperial princesses. But as I mentioned earlier, I can find no evidence of a Seneca-Agrippina sexual tie-up, and Suaelius was probably playing on the pair's former closeness as political allies, a relationship that had soured considerably by AD 58. The attack on Seneca's virtus or manliness didn't stop there. Suaelius was really getting into his stride and playing to the gallery. He knew that virtus was one of the core values of what a Roman male considered himself to be all about, and he knew that impugning Seneca's manliness quotient was going to fall on a lot of receptive ears. So Suaelius, having informed everyone present that not only had he been on active campaign, but had been on active campaign with the great general Germanicus, told his audience that the only things that Seneca understood were academic activities and immature youths. The Latin words Suaelius actually uses are studiis inertibus, or pursuits that do not involve physical action. So again, a dig at Seneca's non-martial involvement. And the juvenum imperitii, or immature youths, is probably a reference to Nero himself. I don't read that bit about immature youths as a sexual slur on Seneca. Rather, I think it was designed by Suaelius to highlight that the company Seneca kept, in the form of Nero and his cronies, was to be taken in stark contrast to the manly and martial company that Suaelius himself laid claim to. And because of these things, riled Suaelius, Seneca actively envied men who vigorously exercised genuine and untainted oratory to the advantage and benefit of their fellow citizens. See, Suaelius was going for a serious emasculation job here, and he ended this part of his character assassination by comparing his own crime of venal activity while an advocate, something that he calls the acceptance of rewards a dependent offers voluntarily for an honest job, favourably with Seneca seducing imperial princesses. After that full frontal assault on Seneca's virtus, Suaelius shifted focus to something else that he felt Seneca's behaviour and reputation had laid him wide open to, his hypocrisy. Suaelius's entire diatribe from here on in was geared to proving Seneca a total and utter hypocrite. Every accusation he laid down was intended to prove that what Seneca preached and what Seneca actually did were polar opposites. He must have been working on the assumption that if he could discredit Seneca, the architect of his downfall, enough, his own punishment would be mitigated accordingly. Suaelius pointed out the discrepancy between Seneca's written words and his corresponding actions, clearly taking aim at De Clementia, or On Clemency, Seneca's doomed literary endeavour to corral Nero's behaviour into that of a philosopher king. Suaelius pointed out that although Seneca had denounced tyranny, he was the teacher of a tyrant. Now that's proof right there that Nero's welcome as emperor was already beginning to wear thin with the Roman upper classes, even after 4 short years. Moreover, continued Suaelius, for somebody who in his writings advised against associating with the powerful, why was Seneca himself always hanging around the imperial palace? The next item on the hypocrisy list was an absolute doozy because Suaelius had Seneca bang to rights. Seneca, he said, decried fawners and flatterers, and yet, referring directly what can only be Seneca's Consolatio ad Polybium, a work that we covered in a previous podcast, the grovelling, fawning, grease-up attempt to get Claudius to recall Seneca from exile on Corsica, that is exactly what Seneca himself had been guilty of. To push home his point, and an interesting point for us reading the words 2,000 years down the track, Suaelius points out that Seneca had attempted to suppress that work out of shame. And that again is something that I don't think Suaelius would have tried on unless it was already out there in the public domain. And still, the accusations of hypocrisy kept on coming. Suaelius pointed out Seneca's frequent literary harangues against Rome's uber wealthy and their decadent lifestyles surrounded by opulence and luxurious goods. But hadn't Seneca himself, he asked, acquired a fortune of 300 million sesterces, an absolute fortune in today's terms, in 4 short years? Didn't Seneca own 500 tables made of citrus wood with legs of ivory on which he served gut-busting banquets? What bunch of learning, what philosophical school had won him 300 million sesterces in the 4 odd years since he had become the emperor's amicus Principis, his principal advisor? He accused Seneca of being no better than a legacy hunter who enticed the childless into his snares while charging purse-busting rates of interest on his loans that were sucking Italia and the provinces dry. And the mention of the provinces here is important to note, as Seneca is also accused of loan sharking local dignitaries in the fledgling province of Britannia. Suaelius's litany of condemnation still wasn't finished. Back on the subject of sexual deviance, he accused Seneca of infidelity to his wife, Pompeia Paulina. Now, she was not Seneca's first wife. There's evidence of at least one other who died previously. And Suaelius implies that Seneca had married somewhat above his station. So the match was possibly contracted shortly after Seneca's return from exile. Yet Suaelius insinuates that despite Seneca making such a good marital catch, it did not stop him from continuing to take pleasure in young men barely out of childhood. Or boyhood, really. And Suaelius blames Seneca for passing that particular vice onto Nero. Now, again, that last accusation is probably not the sexual slur that it may sound. Rather, it's likely the interpretation by a different commentator of one we mentioned earlier. That is, that Seneca's only company seemed to be that of Nero and his cronies, rather than the manly and/or military company Suaelius was attempting to portray himself as keeping. Now, Suaelius concludes by trumpeting that he would rather accept whatever punishment was due to him for his supposed crime of jurisprudential venality than have his lifelong efforts wiped out by this subitae felicitati, this successful or fortunate upstart. And we have to remember here that Seneca, like Cicero before him, had not been born into the patrician class, but into the equites or knightly order. And therefore, to men like Suaelius, Seneca was a novus homo, a new man, a newcomer, and as such, somebody Suaelius saw as a social inferior. So, if Seneca had indeed, as I suspect, been the key instigator in bringing the case against Suaelius, that consideration must have got right up the dodgy old advocate's nose. Now, Seneca was no sitting duck, and he wasn't going to take Suaelius's verbal barrage lying down. As I've mentioned several times in this podcast already, it was probably Seneca himself who had instigated a so-called investigation. that managed to dredge up all sorts of nefarious things that Suaelius had done during the reign of Claudius. Suaelius's response to those accusations was that he had acted under Claudius's instructions, but Seneca must have predicted that tactic, and it was likely he himself that primed Nero to intercede and state that Claudius's personal papers were proof that Nero's late stepfather had never interceded in any trial's outcome. So cut off at that pass, Suaelius switched tack and tried to blame Messalina for ordering him to pervert justice, but nobody was going to believe that story either. The outcome of the trial was that Suaelius was found guilty, with half of his estate being confiscated and the other half split between his son and granddaughter. As for Suaelius himself, he was exiled to the Balearic Islands in the Mediterranean, hardly a hardship, where he must have had a fair bit of his ill-gotten wealth stashed away secretly because, by all accounts, he managed to live out the remainder of his days in self-indulgent luxury. But the question remained as to whether Suaelius, despite losing his own case, had done enough to take Seneca, the self-professed paragon of philosophical abstinence and moderation, down with him. The short answer to that question is a resounding no. There is no doubt that Seneca's seeming hypocrisy, the massive and glaring disparity between what he preached and what he practiced, was becoming increasingly noticeable to more and more people. But it was going to take much more than the ranting vitriol of a bent old advocate to get one over on Lucius Annaeus Seneca, a man for whom the stylus had always been far mightier than the sword. And his response, when it came, was brilliant, devastating, and brutal. And it will be the subject of my next podcast, so I hope to see you all there.